from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's no accident that Barack Obama made Stevie Wonder's Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours his campaign theme song. Obama's appeal jumped racial barriers, but Stevie Wonder was Motown, and Motown did it first. Half a century ago now, when Detroit, Motor City, was booming, and a new generation of pop was young. This hour on Point, we're looking back on Motown. You can join the conversation. What made the Motown sound work across the country? What made the country ready for Motown? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We will hear in this hour from Motown mover Suzanne DePass, who was there, and from Raphael Sadiq, producer for Joss Stone and Snoop Dogg, on Motown's legacy today. But first, joining me from New York is Lisa Robinson. Her big story in the December issue of Vanity Fair is It Happened in Hitsville. It's an oral history of the legendary music label Motown. Lisa, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. And with us in the studio, Tim Riley, music critic and author of Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Good to see you, Tom.
Lisa, this is an incredible oral history, really fun to read. You've got a lot of principles talking about what actually went on and amazing photographs from then and today by Annie Leibovitz, who went out and photographed a bunch of these folks, Barry Gordy and Smokey Robinson and a whole lot more. Now, 50 years, we're coming right up on here, I guess, and you're diving back into Motown. You say there's a myth and there's a reality, and what's the gap between the two, Lisa?
Well, the thing about Motown is that for this generation who remembers maybe some of the music or their parents listened to it, or their grandparents listened to it, there was Dreamgirls, which came out, you know, a couple years ago. And it portrayed a black record label in Detroit that a lot of people feel was based on Motown. It was from the Broadway show that was loosely based on the Supreme story. But in this movie, they made the head of the label kind of this real thug gangster type, and a lot of people felt that that was Berry Gordy, and that was not Berry Gordy. And my quest was to really just sort of, my goal basically was to find out the truth, the people who are still around from that time, what Motown was really like. You hear from the Motown people that it was a family and they all loved each other. You know that it was a hit factory because they just had hundreds and hundreds of songs that came out that were played on the radio. All the acts were on the Ed Sullivan Show. The music really crossed over in a way that no black music had beforehand. And it was a culturally, racially, politically, but mostly musical story. But in terms of it being a family, that's where the myth and the reality did not come together. And that was one of the main goals of my trying to do this. It took 5 years for Suzanne DePass and I to be able to convince Berry Gordy to cooperate with this. And it took 9 months for Annie Leibovitz and I to be able to photograph everyone and for me to do hundreds, hundreds of hours of interviews, really, to sort of, you know, bring it down to these 7,000 words that are in the current Vanity Fair.
5 years, plus the provocation of Dreamgirls, which really got under Berry Gordy Jr.'s skin. He does not want to be remembered as a gangster. That's just not his thing, clearly.
No, you know, Berry Gordy said that all the hip-hop guys who kept saying things to him like, oh, they got Gotti, but they couldn't get you. And he said, no, that's not what it was. You didn't understand. Motown could not have happened if it was that kind of an atmosphere. Berry Gordy, first of all, was a songwriter. He started Motown, and then soon thereafter, Smokey Robinson joined him, because they wanted to get paid. Because a lot of songwriters were not getting paid. Black songwriters certainly were not getting paid. Most of the record companies were white. They couldn't get the records on the radio. He started the label in 1958 with an $800 loan from his family. He owned it. He and his family owned it. Smokey Robinson was a partner. Smokey Robinson, as we know, is one of the great, great songwriters in the history of the world. Bob Dylan called him America's greatest poet. I think that's pretty complimentary coming from Bob Dylan. Smokey Robinson actually was even more offended by Dreamgirls. Berry Gordy's pretty, he's relaxed about it. He wants people to know the truth, and he knows what the truth is. We spent many, many hours together. This was a man who's been pretty reclusive for years. So to be able to
get his mansion in Bel Air.
In his mansion in Bel Air, which coincidentally, if you ever see Lady Sings the Blues again, it's a movie that Diana Ross starred in, obviously, as Billie Holiday, and Barry Gordy produced it. There's a scene in that movie that shows her in a sanitarium on a lawn in a chair. That was filmed at Barry Gordy's mansion.
We're going to hear a lot of music in this hour. Let's get the very first release from the Motown label in our ears right now. It's Marv Johnson, 1959. Come to Me, released January 21st, 1959, the first release for Motown Records. January 1959, the first Motown release. Jim Varley, they clearly hadn't fully found their stride there yet, but they found it soon, and we'll hear more of that. What was it about the Motown sound that jumped over, that jumped the wall? I mean, everybody, black and white, was dancing to this and did for a long, long time. What was the new thing they got onto here?
Well, they had, you know, as Lisa has said, they had a stable of great songwriters. They had great players in their band that they called the Funk Band. Benny Benjamin on drums and Richard Allen and James Jamerson on bass. So they had great players. What Barry Gordy was able to do was he was able to transform this pop music, what he called America's favorite music, into something even more than just crossover music, which was black pop appealing to white audiences.
Mm-hmm.
It quickly became symbolic of something much larger that was in the air at the time, which was, you know, during the civil rights era, people's biggest fears, or the anti-integrationist biggest fears, was that white and blacks would start dancing together. Right?
Watch out.
And this is what Barry Gordy set in motion. And so that whites and blacks were listening to each other's music and playing each other's music and dancing with one another to Motown hits. And that became almost as powerful an idea as the music itself.
And it came to hits in a big hurry. Let's hear Money. Here's 1960. This was the first big hit for Motown, co-written by Barry Gordy himself. Barry Strong and Money, That's What I Want.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want.
Money, the first big hit. What was he after, Lisa Robinson? What did he tell you? How did he visualize or hear the sound he was going for, Barry Gordy?
Well, first of all, I just have to say that Money was covered by the Beatles, and then in the 80s it was covered by the Flying Lizards in a great sort of modern, sexy, funny version. That is a song that lasted. And the reason that all of the Motown songs, I think, still sound good, and why you have people like Raphael Sadiq or Neo or people influenced, Amy Winehouse, people influenced by it, the songs were seductive and catchy. Barry Gordy's goal was to get you in the first 20 seconds. If the song did not grab you, it did not have a hook, if it didn't have something hummable in the first 20 seconds, he wouldn't release it. And in my article, I talk about their quality control meetings that they had every Friday at Motown, where everyone would vote on the record. And Barry Gordy would not let anyone in if they were not there by 9 o'clock in the morning. Smokey Robinson even got locked out lots of times. And he said to people, if you had a dollar and you could only buy this record or a hamburger, what would you buy? And if it wasn't the record, he wouldn't put it out. And when you think of songs like Dancing in the Streets, Heat Wave, Baby Love, Shop Around, Hitchhike, Living in the City, Fingertips, all these unbelievable, Ball of Confusion, What's Going On, Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
The songs absolutely, in addition to whatever subliminal messages and political impact they had, they were catchy and they were hummable. And one more thing I wanted to say about what Tim said was in terms of the dancing in the article, both Martha Reeves and Otis Williams of the Temptations, both of whom we photographed, talk about how when the Temptations toured in the South in the beginning of the 60s, there was a rope down the middle of the audience. White kids had to stay on one side, black kids had to stay on another, and they couldn't intermingle and dance together. And by the end of the 60s, by 1968, that rope was gone.
The rope was gone, and Motown was huge, hit after hit, number one after number one, and all kinds of race lines crossed. Lisa Robinson is with us from Vanity Fair. It Happened in Hitsville is her big story. Check out the Annie Leibovitz photos from today and the great album from yesterday in the magazine, an oral history of what went down at Motown. Tim Riley, author of Fever, is with us as well. You can join us. Motown at half a century we're looking at. Behind us, Shop Around from 1961, the first Motown single to sell a million copies, but by no means the last. Did you grow up on Motown? Did your parents, does it still make you just want to get up and dance? Did you think of Motown music as black, as white, as just American? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, and on the web at WBUR.org. In the forecast tonight, rain and drizzle, temperatures staying in the 40s. Tomorrow, possible morning rain, cloudy for the rest of the day, and in the low 60s. Saturday, showers, breezy upper 50s. On Sunday, a chance of morning showers, otherwise partly sunny and in the low 50s. And on Monday, cloudy possible showers in the upper 40s. It's 46 degrees in Boston at 8:19. In sports, the Patriots and the Jets just getting underway at Gillette Stadium. And after one period, now in the second period, the Bruins are leading Montreal for nothing.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Executive MBA program, named New England's top program by Financial Times. Application deadline November 14th, bu.edu/executive MBA. The Huntington Theater Company presenting Rock and Roll, written by four-time Tony Award winner Tom Stoppard, now playing huntingtontheater.org. And Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, with a commitment to banking and investment services in the tradition of the world's leading private banks. BostonPrivateBank.com.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Motown at half a century, the big 60s sound of Detroit and its legacy in music and beyond. You can join the conversation. Who did you love? Smokey, Stevie, Diana Ross, the Commodores, and why Detroit? Why then? What made Motown? Of course, dancing in the streets behind us, Martha and the Vandellas, 1964. Lisa Robinson is here. She's got a big new oral history and photo album of Motown in Vanity Fair's December issue. It's really terrific. Tim Riley's with us as well, music critic, author of Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. And you can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're going to hear in just a moment from Motown big, Suzanne DePass. Let's get a call or two first here. Doug in Randolph, Massachusetts. Doug, you're on the air. What do you remember? What do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up about a mile and a half from the Detroit city line, and I graduated from high school in 1967, so that can give you a little perspective.
Yeah.
Every year, we used to go down to the Fox Theater in downtown Detroit and watch the Motown Review, Supremes, Temptations, Smokey. Back then, Little Stevie Wonder. It was fabulous. We had 40 guys on our football team on the bus harmonizing to What's Your Name? Black and white kids. I used to go down to West Grand just to look at the studio and go down to West Chicago to look at Barry Gordon's mansion just to, like, pay homage to it. It absolutely informed everybody at that time.
And were you looking at it from the white side or the black side, and did it matter? How did you see? How did you hear the music racially, or did you?
Well, I'm white, and my high school was mixed. We had about 30% black and the rest white, but it didn't matter. Didn't matter at all. We all just loved it. We all went down to the Fox Theater every holiday, see the Motown Review, and it didn't matter. It was fabulous.
No question. Thanks, Doug, for calling. Lisa.
I just wanted to say that in my article, Dr. Mm-hmm. Cornel West was quoted as saying that the genius of Berry Gordy was that the black kids on the black side of town thought it was their music, and the white kids who had been listening to the Beach Boys or the Beatles also thought it was their music. And even though this was music that came from a tradition of black music like blues and doo-wop and early rock and roll, and even jazz, because Berry Gordy was influenced by jazz,
mm-hmm.
he never felt this was black music. He said it was music made by black musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And Motown really was colorless in that it just seduced people by the music. And as Tim had mentioned, also the Funk Brothers, you know, that bass, James Jamerson's bass line and Benny Benjamin's drum, that rhythm section just made it move. It was just so unbelievably sexy, seductive, catchy. And it was really because of the music. And the politics, the racial barriers being broken down, that really sort of was a wonderful byproduct of the music.
Colorless, you say, and yet you quote Berry Gordy saying he and Diana Ross, who were very close, were among the first who started calling one another black. They wanted to be black. They fought and talked about black pride even as they made this music that went everywhere.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm glad that you really read it. Thank you. He did say that. He wanted to have that not be a negative term, because he said at that time black was considered a negative word, that people said Negro, that he wanted people to be proud of being black. So he called her black and she called him black. In fact, if you watch a tape or a DVD of the Motown 25th anniversary special, which Suzanne DePass produced and got Emmys for, which Michael Jackson did that incredible dance in, and you see Diana Ross call Berry Gordy down to the stage. She yells out, "Black, come on down." So that is something that they did call each other. Of course, Berry, who has a fantastic sense of humor, did say, of course, this was before black was beautiful. He was kidding about that. But they did call each other that, yes.
Suzanne DePass, former president of Motown Records, she was an assistant, creative assistant to Berry Gordy, Motown founder, discovered the Jackson 5, the Commodores, received all kinds of awards over the years, Emmy, Golden Globe, Peabody Awards. She's now CEO of DePass Entertainment and joins us. We're very pleased to have her from Los Angeles. Suzanne DePass, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. This is some spread Vanity Fair's laid out on you. It looks pretty grand here, Suzanne.
Well, I have to say, Lisa Robinson did a magnificent job. I can't find the words to say how wonderful her not only her writing, but the tenacity with which she approached just hanging in there to get this done, because I think at sometimes she was pulling her hair out and it was like managing a flea circus.
There's a pretty great photograph from Annie Leibovitz in here of you and Lionel Richie at his pool in, I don't know, Beverly Hills, it looks like.
Yeah.
Looks like you're living pretty large there, Suzanne.
Well, no, I'm living large on his dime. But when I think about the first time that I saw Lionel as a member of the Commodores and the audition that we had, and, you know, they were all sort of living in one room in a motel and traveling in a sort of a rickety old van, and you walk into Lionel's house today and you think, you know, this is what talent will get you, because he has a magnificent home and he's a wonderful, wonderful creative and just entertainer. You know,
No kidding.
Yeah, he's great.
What made it work, Suzanne? What was it that Berry Gordy was on to? I mean, how did he articulate? He wanted catchy music. He wanted seductive music. But then people had wanted catchy, seductive music for a long time. And he came up with something different here. You could recognize it immediately. How do you articulate what that was?
I think the genius of Berry Gordy is really, that's not a myth. And his ability to not only recognize the talent of other people, but to be able to bring it out. And he created an atmosphere of, what I would call not only competition, but the kind of friendly competition where, you were competing with the person next to you, but you were also helping them in the studio if they needed hand claps or if they needed background voices and it was phenomenal in the sense that after I got there, I got there at the kind of the end of the beginning, and mm-hmm. Tom, I want to thank you for the promotion to president of Motown Records, but I was actually president of Motown Productions. Television. I'll take it. but it wouldn't be true.
Yeah.
I think the tone that he set, the standard, I mean, he is a perfectionist, and I refer to him not only as my mentor, but my tormentor. He's affectionate, but it's true.
Right.
Because his standards are still so high, and he has a way of instilling in you a desire to reach for the bar that he sets higher and higher and higher every time. And so while, I mean, there were times when you would be in despair because it wasn't working or something was, he wasn't pleased, but instead of it being something that would discourage you and make you want to fold your tent and go home, it just made us all try real hard.
And
harder and harder.
I have to ask you, of course, Stevie Wonder was one of those. Lisa writes, Smokey Robinson, remember that everybody had to be on time, but maybe Stevie was late a time or two to those famous meetings.
Stevie is always late.
Well, okay. But, I was out in Denver in the big Invesco Stadium in August and actually ended up on the stage with Stevie Wonder when he was rehearsing for the big play-in he gave Barack Obama that night. And I've been thinking ever since about what is it that links these. I mean, here I wonder if you do, Suzanne. Here we've got this president-elect who's jumped over racial boundaries, not just by his parentage, but something in the way he interacts with the country. And I wonder if there is some link back to what Berry Gordy was up to there.
I would hope that there is. And I think that, while we don't want to overthink it,
mm-hmm.
When you think about, at the end of the day, what comes through from people is that really what Dr. King said about the content of someone's character. And that is a very powerful thing that I think Barack Obama brought forward. But I also think that the content of the music and the content of the care and the professionalism and it wasn't that the music was good and the performances were bad or the costumes were raggedy. Every single detail was attended to in order to really bring something so special and so good to the public. And I think that is something that has no racial connotation. The people in this world who are impactful and great transcend all of the details about what they look like.
Let's hear a little bit from some music that you brought to Berry Gordy and or the group anyway, and through him to the world. I Want You Back, the Jackson 5, 1969. The Jackson 5, not a bad find. Lisa Robinson, you told her, Suzanne, that it wasn't so easy to get Berry Gordy to listen to these boys.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. And oh, go ahead, Lisa.
Well, Suzanne, well, no, I was just going to say one thing quickly to just refer to what you were saying about President-elect Obama and Berry Gordy and any similarities. One of the things Berry Gordy did say to me was that he was concerned more about what people had in common as opposed to what their differences were and the similarities in people. And everybody cared about love and everybody wanted to be happy or people got sad or they needed money. And I think that that's something that's just a universal truth. And I think we saw in this election that the things that united us were the things that made us all sort of the same, not the differences.
Suzanne,
but
I want to come to you.
To get to the Jackson 5 for 1 second, Suzanne told me that Berry Gordy didn't want the Jackson 5 because he didn't want any more kids. Because they had that chaperone.
Up to here with that Stevie Wonder kid.
Suzanne, tell him about the contracts that Stevie Wonder had to have approved and the chaperone.
Well, no, I mean, the point is that he just said, I said, I saw this great act. He said, great. I said, I think you should sign them. He said, great. I said, I'm telling you, Mr. Gordy, these kids, he said, kids. I don't want any kids.
Right.
At which point he launched into this thing, which I had no clue about. I'm you know, a college dropout at this point, and I'm trying to find my way, and he scared me to death, to tell you the truth. So when after he turned me down and I had to go back, it really was mustering up every ounce of courage to say, Mr. Gordy, I know you said no, but I really,
That's a great. I don't want chaperones. I don't want to deal with teachers.
It was court approval of the contract.
Right.
And it was teacher welfare workers, and it was just, you know, and yet, the wonderful thing about Berry Gordy is that if you really, really believe in something and you're willing to step out there with the possibility that the limb will be sawed off behind you, he finds that pretty compelling because he's also kind of a gambler and, you know, he thinks that if you have the courage of your convictions, you know, then he'll maybe pay attention to you.
It worked out pretty well for him. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Cal in Boston. Cal, you're on the air.
How are you?
Very well, sir. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to say what a great show, say how awesome it is to hear Ms. DePass, who is truly a pioneer, and say how great it is to have this wonderful article coming out. Nonetheless, I would like to say that the statement that Motown was this sort of ethnically neutral, omni-American enterprise denies the impact of black people who moved to Detroit through the Great Migration from the South, who were oftentimes from Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, where I happen to be from originally.
Uh-huh.
And I think to say that the Motown sound was not black is wrong. The Motown sound was black, but it was black in a way that jazz is black or the blues is black. They're American creations that draw people in as opposed to pushing people out, which is exactly the connection between Barack Obama and Berry Gordy. So I don't want the concept to be thought that soul Motown was not black. It was black, but it spread and became a part of the wider America.
Cal, we've got you loud and clear. Why do you think this particular strain of then black music, if you will, was so appealing across color lines? What was it about this? I mean, every R&B, jazz, they all had huge audiences, but this was number one again and again and again.
Well, this was a product not necessarily of the idiom. I mean, Miles Davis was the biggest musician in his time before the popular movements of soul music happened. What happened was the democratization of recording playback technology. So record players and 8-track tape players were dispersed more easily. So more people throughout the world were able to hear this music in a more democratic way.
Suzanne, what do you say?
Well, you know, I don't think anything that we're talking about would deny the fact that Motown was black. Clearly, Lisa said that, you know, it was music made by black people with all of the wonderful influences from the church and from the street and from jazz. And you know, it kind of fused together all of that. I think the obvious thing to me when I got there was that there was a very egalitarian atmosphere. And Berry Gordy was way before his time in terms of allowing and inviting women to take positions of great responsibility. And there were white people there and black people there and Asian people there. And his, it was inside the walls a bit of a melting pot, but it was certainly from a black perspective. So, I mean, I think that, that the gentleman who's calling, and thank you for the kind words, is correct that we don't want to leave the impression that this was not a black enterprise nor influenced by the cultural impact that the great American migration to Detroit had, and also the fact that the automotive industry was employing black people to such an extent that there was this whole newfound middle class, if you will, and people who were hard working people who had come to find a better life. So there were tremendous, you know, social and cultural and impactful things that allowed the pool of talent for Berry Gordy to pick from to be as diverse and wonderful as it was. But I think that we can't deny the fact, and I think that the
colors there. Suzanne, hold the thought. We've got to go to a short break right here. Forgive me. Lisa Robinson, Suzanne DePass, Tim Riley, please stand by. Here's Ball of Confusion, 1970. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with more of Motown at 50. That's what the world is today. Yeah. Fear in the air, tension everywhere. Unemployment rising fast, the Beatles' new record again.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, and on the web at WBUR.org. Next, it's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, the collapse of a famous brokerage house, and what that reveals about the larger economic crisis. Donate your unwanted used automobile to WBUR. You may be eligible for a tax deduction, and you'll help pay for the news. To learn more about our vehicle donation program, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 909-WBUR. And thanks.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Elephant Walk Restaurants, Cambodian and French cuisine for all lifestyles and budgets, including full vegetarian and gluten-free menus. Reservations at elephantwalk.com. And Zimmen, celebrating 100 years, more than 15,000 decorative fabrics in stock, unique furnishings, upholstered furniture, and custom services. Zimmens.com.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. WBUR listeners stay informed by staying tuned right through the day. At 1 o'clock on Fresh Air, I interview people in the worlds of arts, culture, and current affairs. At 2, you can join the conversation on NPR's Talk of the Nation. And at 3, day-to-day updates you on all the latest stories. Every day, all day, your source for news and information is 90.9 WBUR and WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Motown at half a century. If you don't recognize this one from way back there, not a surprise. It's called Big Easy by Rafael Sadiq. We'll join us in just a moment. It's 2008, but can you not hear Motown still moving strong right there? Suzanne DePass joins us this hour. She's former president of Motown Productions and a big wheel alongside Berry Gordy in the 1960s and beyond life. of Motown Records. Lisa Robinson with Vanity Fair is with us. She's got a great oral history of those early Motown years in the December issue of Vanity Fair, and a terrific photo spread as well. You want to catch it if you can. Tim Riley, music critic, is here, author of Fever. You can join us. What do you think? What made this music sell to everyone, get everyone moving? Does it make sense that they'll play Signed, Sealed, Delivered at Barack Obama's inauguration? How do you hear Motown now, today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Amsterdam by Rafael Sadiq, singer-songwriter, award-winning producer for Joss Stone, The Roots, Snoop Dogg, John Legend, lead singer for the groundbreaking R&B group Tony, Tony, Tony in the 80s. His new solo album, The Way I See It, is new material in 60s soul style. He's in Amsterdam right now on tour with John Legend. Rafael Sadiq, thank you very much for being with us.
How you doing, Tom?
We're great. We hear it loud and clear in that cut right there. I guess Motown made a pretty big impression on you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was definitely like a soundtrack in my life. You know, a lot of people around me. Sure.
And now you've kind of brought it back in your new album. How do you shift gears to get into the Motown groove in your own work, Rafael?
Well, you know, for me, like I said, you know, I grew up playing a lot of quartet music as a kid, but, you know, usually like, you know, three background singers and one lead singer, like, you know, the Soul Stirrers. I played for a lot of, you know, like older groups when I was like, you know, 7, 8 years old. So I was naturally drawn to Motown by that Jackson 5, you know, watching the, you know, Jermaine and Tito and Michael and Marlon, you know, just looking at the Jackson 5, I was naturally ran to that and, you know, Temptations. It was, you know, the first family of soul. I was just drawn to it, and ever since then, and you listen to all the music, like it's nothing like the real thing. It just never leave you. It ends up being like the soundtrack of your life. As a kid, it just grabbed me.
And how do you listen back to that music? It clearly informs your music now, but let's say compared to R&B or compared to Miles Davis, is it a different part of your musical mind that it lives? Is it all one or is it distinct?
It's just all one. I feel like I'm just a part of that tree, and I'm just a branch on that tree that Motown built in all those great musicians. You know, I was, you know, so fortunate to have had you know, Jack Ashford and Paul Reiser on my record, The Way I See It, and you could feel the energy of those cats when they were in the room. You could feel the vibe of Motown, the seriousness and the laughter and the fun, and you could tell it was a lot of fun and trial and great era, you know, and that's what you do. People who love music, you it's trial and error, and it's just having a good time, and always equated with you know, when you have so many people in a room making music, so many people have so many different perspectives and feelings and going through so many different things at home or at work, and when they come in one room, it's all these different energies create this great music. And, you know, I wasn't around to, you know what that was, but, you know, I talked to Stevie Wonder a lot, and he has a lot of great things to say about it. Even he said he was a little young at the time. He didn't get to have all the fun that everybody else had because he was a kid, but he said it was just a great time for music, and it's definitely instilled in me. It's like second nature to me to do what I did and create my record, and I'm just so grateful to have such an inspiration, and so many people create so much great music that lasts forever. You know, this is 50 years, it'll be around forever.
So Zendepass, what's it like to hear a musician of a new generation, Rafael Sadiq, sort of reprising this Motown groove in a whole new way? But here we are in 2008, and he's putting it out with a fresh face.
I love it. I think it's fantastic, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the album. But I think it really does speak, Tom and guests, to the incredible potency of the original music, and to the fact that just like a relay race, it the baton gets passed and accepted by artists of the new generation, and I just think it just is such a wonderful indication of the power of not just the songs themselves, but the intentionality of the music, you know, the feeling of it, the subtext of it, which you know, we can't help but be proud to hear this new music.
Lisa, I hear you there in New York.
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to say that of all the musicians I've talked to over the past four decades, people like Keith Richards and Eric Clapton, for example, have always said to me how they felt they were just carrying it on, passing it on. You know, the blues guys that they grew up listening to, they just were bringing that music to a new generation. And I think Raphael's album, the first notes of the first song, it just brings up how sweet it is to me. I'm not saying he ripped it off. I'm just saying it's influenced. By it just sounds like that. It's the same. There's that great bass, Jameson bass thing running through his whole record, and it's really powerful. It's very important. I think the fact that he's got Stevie Wonder on the album with him on one song is wonderful. The fact that he's worked with Joss Stone, because Joss Stone, along with other singers like Amy Winehouse or Duffy, or you know, young British musicians who are still influenced by this music. It just keeps coming around again. And that's what Suzanne said about passing the baton, and what somebody like Eric Clapton says about just passing it on. They're just being a branch of a tree, like Raphael just said.
And why not? Raphael Sadiq with the new album, The Way I See It, joining us today from Amsterdam. Raphael, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Lisa mentioned Amy Winehouse earlier. Let's listen to a little bit of her. You can hear the Motown here. Back to Black. Listen for the, drawing off of Baby Love here. Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, 2006. Riley Withers there with Amy Winehouse and with Raphael Sadiq. I mean, this is Motown living large, right in front of us.
Yeah, and it's one of the great parts of the whole story is that the British embraced this soul music so firmly and so passionately. Of course, we already mentioned the Beatle covers.
Mm-hmm.
So Motown gets to surf on that British invasion a little bit, which is a very big part of their crossover move. But Amy Winehouse's Back to Black, you know, one of the great Motown tribute records, even though it's mostly all original material, but you can hear that they're trying to create the next great Motown record,
right?
even though she happens to be a British soul singer.
Yeah.
But of course, this is one of the recurring themes in American music, pop music history, is the way Europe reflects our music back to us and legitimizes it, or says to us, you know, you should take this a lot more seriously. There's good stuff here.
Right.
And they mirror it back to us, and it makes us appreciate it more. So it's a key theme in American pop music history.
But Suzanne, Lisa was finding how proud Berry Gordy was in the 1960s, that Motown was going toe-to-toe with the British invasion, putting out hits right in the face of the Beatles and everybody else, even when others were getting swamped by them, Suzanne.
That's true, and I think the Supremes and the Four Tops were probably the standard bearers for that. But you know, I think that you know, when it comes to the Beatles, for instance, the fact that they covered three songs on the album, I forgot which one it was. Lisa will know, but it, you know, Please Mr. Postman and Money,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember what the other one was. But the point is that there was this sort of acknowledgement of what Motown was doing on the part of the, you know, sort of the leaders of the British invasion, and the Supremes were really, you know, you would see the Beatles at number one, the Supremes at number two, or the Supremes at number one, the Beatles at number two, and they almost single-handedly, you know, kept us, that is America, very much alive during that onslaught, and it was. But back then, what was great too was that you could love the Beatles, and you could love the Supremes, and you could love the Four Tops, and you could love Herman Shermans. You know,
why not?
It wasn't as segmented as it is today.
Let's hear them. 1964, the Supremes. Here's Amy Winehouse's Inspiration. Of course, everybody knows the original, Baby Love. just get a call from Baltimore and Martha. Hi, Martha. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have to tell you that I graduated from high school in 71 in Atlanta, Georgia. And that was the time that everything was in transition. I grew up listening, or as a kid and as a high school student and all, listening to Motown. It was what we listened to, and I got to tell you, never could get it out of me. It's been wonderful. I want to say, I went to a high school down there that was mostly white public school.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, dances, and the band that we'd always try to get for the dances was a bunch of high school kids from a close by school.
Yeah.
All white band, except the singer was black, and did all the Motown songs. And I mean to tell you, it was really, it changed the way people thought. They were just such a big part of the whole experience then. Things were becoming integrated, and there were people that felt all which ways about it in Atlanta, which is...
I'm sure they did, and the music right there, and the bands itself covering it, helping cross those passes. Martha, thanks for calling from Baltimore. Thanks very much. Let's get one more from New Haven, Connecticut. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Tom, this is Benita. Lynn, I call myself.
Okay.
I'm calling because I just wanted to say how much I really enjoyed Motown as a kid. Growing up, my mom would always play it, and I remember the very first song I really remember was Stevie Wonder's Fingertips, and I went crazy because he was like maybe 3 years older than I was at the time, and I had a crush that I kept forever on him because I thought he did the greatest, singing in the world. And I grew up loving the Jackson 5 and thinking, oh, my goodness, look at these young boys. And they were about our ages, sisters and brothers. And, it just had such a wonderful sound. And when I hear it now, even today, I still get those same great feelings that I got when I was a kid.
But, Monica, did it matter to you, or did you think about the fact, as a girl, that young white kids and black kids were all listening to the same thing? Was that invisible, or did it matter? Did it factor into how you heard it?
I think as I grew older, the thing that I noticed is I used to watch American Bandstand,
mm-hmm.
and what I would notice is that most of the time the kids that were dancing were white, but the songs would be black.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, who
and
doesn't?
I think that's probably the only thing that really, went through my mind at that time. I think maybe as I grew older, but when I was, 10, 11, 12, no, it didn't really mean a lot to me, except for I did notice that I never really saw black kids on American Bandstand, but I always heard black music.
But the music was flowing every which way. Lynn, thanks very much for calling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tim Riley, you were nodding earlier when we were talking about Barack Obama and this music. I think you had a thought there.
Yeah, how they used to call Bill Clinton the first black president. I think that you could make a good case that Barack Obama will be our first Motown president, and not just because of the integrated background that he comes from,
mm-hmm.
but as you look at old videos of these performers on YouTube, on the appearances they made on the Ed Sullivan Show, in order to cross over and win over that white audience. Has really expected a lot more of their black performers. And you just go down the list, the James Browns, the Jimi Hendrix,
the bar was high.
Michael Jackson. They couldn't just be good,
mm-hmm.
right? They had to be superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we see that same thing sort of surrounding the expectant mood around Obama's presidency. We are expecting him. We are bringing a huge expectations game to play here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because that's part of what we required of these black performers back in the 60s was to not just be good, but to be so much better that in order to cross over and win over the white audience, we expected a lot more of them.
Lisa, what did you come away from your 5 years with here? That's a lot of talking you did.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing about the expectations of black performers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was only, and certainly not just white audiences. I remember Jerry Butler telling me that when he performed at the Apollo, and this isn't a Motown artist, but this was years ago, Jerry Butler, the Iceman, said that when he performed at the Apollo, and Suzanne can tell you because she produced Showtime at the Apollo for years, he said, when you got on that stage, you had to be so unbelievably great because half the audience was as good as you were. And so I think that the expectations in the black community of their artists, especially because of the church and the choirs and the whole gospel thing, the bar was set so high. Listen, the Supremes' Baby Love, that came about after 4 years of them not having a hit. They kept putting out records with the Supremes, but it didn't hit until then. And Fingertips, which one of our callers just
Stevie
mentioned,
Wonders, yep.
That was a mistake. That was a lucky mistake that happened on stage at the Fox Theater in Detroit, and it, to me, is one of the first great psychedelic songs of the 60s. At any rate, you can read about all these behind-the-scenes things in Vanity Fair now. It's on sale on the stands now.
Well, lucky for all of us.
Yeah, we quick thing, Lisa. Yes, you know, Jerry Butler did get to Motown. We did sign him eventually.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah.
That's great. Well,
Motown
see,
touched everybody.
<That's>
lucky
great.
For us, the music was all there, and lucky for us to have the three of you with us this hour. Suzanne DePass in Los Angeles, a real privilege to speak with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.
Tim Riley, author of Fever, always great to have you, Tim. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Lisa Robinson with Vanity Fair. Thanks for everything, Lisa.
Thank you, Tom.
Behind us, War, 1970. Go Motown. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.